The House Committee on Revenue for February 4th, 2016 will come to order. Colleagues, and for those who are paying attention to the agenda, please be aware that we are moving over until tomorrow the public hearing and work session on House Bill 4131, which is the last item on this agenda. It actually will not be heard today. It will be heard tomorrow. And with that, we will open the public hearing on House Bill 4025, the connection to the federal income tax code. Do you want to give us a quick summary? And I think we have at least one person who wants to be heard. Do we?
Yes.
Yeah. While she's doing that, would Jürgen Kritschager come to the table, please? And if I butchered your name, you can correct it in a minute. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4025 would update the connection date to Federal Internal Revenue Code, and it would change the connection dates to December 31st, 2015, for various programs. I was going to talk a little bit about the rolling reconnect and some of the impacts that have happened due to policy changes there. But first, to talk directly about the revenue impacts of this measure. Since the Internal Revenue Code date has been updated to December 31st, 2015, some of the changes to the earned income tax credit are affecting Oregon revenue due to this one of the changes in this measure. And so what they have done in the Protecting Americans from Tax Hikes Act is to create a credit percentage for the EITC of 45% for people with three or more qualifying children. And that had been sunsetting at the end of 2017. And what the measure did was extended that out and made it permanent. There's also an increase in the beginning and ending income levels for joint returns by 5,000, and that's just indexed from 2009, so it's a little bit more by now. And that was in a similar situation previously extended through 2017 and then made permanent. So the revenue impact is a $2 million loss in 2017-19, and then it phases up to $5.4 million in loss in 1921, and that is really, it's based on the numbers, the estimates from the Joint Committee on Taxation at the federal level, and then there's a method through which they're shared with Oregon. It is based on the proportion. We have data of the earned income tax credits received by Oregon taxpayers, and then relative to the total amount, and that percentage is applied to come up with this number. The measure is...
Excuse me, has a revenue impact statement been published?
Yes, it has, Mr. Chair.
Okay. It's not in OLAS, unless I've got it messed up somehow. It's under meeting materials. Then.
Yes, it here under meeting materials.
It's not under analysis. All right.
Correct.
All right. It should be under analysis as well, since we have a category for it there.
Correct. Briefly to touch on some of the changes, there's a... meeting material there called Annual Revenue Impacts to Oregon for 2016. And this really is about some of the impacts to the changes that have been made in federal tax policy, that Oregon receives these impacts because of the connection that is already in statute, that is really where the taxable income is adopted. And some of the bigger elements of this would be the additional first-year bonus depreciation for 50% of the basis of qualified property, and that's been extended through 2019. And for the impact in fiscal year 2016-17 is $113.1 million. So that's the largest item there. Again, I've been looking for maybe a more accurate way to share that out. It comes from the Joint Committee on Taxation estimates, and then it's based on a proportion of tax rates for corporate tax rates at the national level versus Oregon, and then also shared out according to personal income. And the jury would be out on whether that is really a good estimate of depreciable assets in the federal level versus in Oregon. But there's maybe a lack of better data out there to kind of quantify that. The second largest impact is the permanent extension and modification of increased expensing limitations and treatment of certain real property as Section 179 property. And so this is really due to the...
Now, excuse me a moment. Is this actually on this bill, or is it on the fact that we are tied to the definition of income at the federal level?
Mr. Chair, this is, aside from this bill, this is due to the decision to tie to the income at the
right.
federal level.
So this isn't specifically about this bill?
Correct.
Okay. Let's go on to other items then.
Okay.
It's confusing to me when we look at an impact like this when I think it's related to a decision that we're about to make. And in fact, this is a decision that was made a long time ago and is not related to this bill, if I understand that correctly.
Correct.
All right. So let's go ahead and finish your analysis, and we'll get to this issue another time.
Okay. So this under Section 179, the taxpayer may deduct the cost of qualifying property subject to limitation. And the recent years, the maximum amount that could be expensed was $500,000.
Excuse me. Perhaps I may have misstated. Is the 179 issue you're describing, is that part of the matter in this bill?
No.
Thank you. Then let's not talk about the items that are not part of this bill.
Okay.
They're not relevant to this conversation today. And I don't want to confuse the committee members, because I'm already confused.
Okay.
And I'd rather not confuse the audience who might think that the things you're discussing now are actually related to the bill when they're not. So let's go ahead and finish up with the things that are related to this bill, and then we'll hear from our witness.
Okay. So the only things particularly in this bill are those two changes to the earned income tax credit that I had described earlier, and everything else is aside from that.
And we may very well look at that another time, but if it's not related to this bill, then it isn't germane, unless there's an amendment that would somehow or another bring it in. I'm not aware of one.
No. Also, there is a -1 amendment, and that would just update some due dates for decedents for the family members to file for taxes. There had been some changes at the federal level, and the -1 would make the due dates consistent with what is due at the federal level. But that's the only amendment. It's considered a more of a technical fix.
Right. And we did discuss that with the CPAs yesterday, didn't we, with that amendment. Right. I recognize it. That's doing pretty well. All right. Thank you. Mr. And I'll let you pronounce your own name for us, please.
My name is Jürgen Kritschko.
Thank you. Go ahead and give your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jürgen Kritschko, as I said, and I'm with Tax Fairness Oregon.
Yes.
As I understand, the CPAs took you through massive numbers of changes yesterday, extensions, permanent changes to the federal tax code. Some of those changes provide little specific benefit to Oregon except at tax preparation time. We hope you will look at the cost drivers in the legislation and before you decide to automatically connect to everything. What are the total cost of the package, and do you really agree with all of these items? It is doubtful that you would choose so separately to support several of the high cost items in the list with Oregon tax breaks or grants if they came to either Revenue or Ways and Means Committee as separate bills. Please request a list of the major cost drivers and consider them item by item. It would be prudent, in my opinion, to establish a task force to explore whether Oregon, with its clearly specific tax code, can afford the luxury of remaining fully connected to the federal tax code, which we can't influence, rather than being independent in our own tax code.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. I have to say, I think that's an excellent suggestion. Most of the high cost items are related to things that we are connected to by laws that already are in place. And the item that when I interrupted our staff today, she was talking about those kinds of things. I think your suggestion that we consider whether we want to be as tightly connected to the federal government on the definition of income is an excellent one. Of course, it's a position I've taken for a long time.
There you go.
And I welcome the suggestion. We might very well take it up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 4025? I don't see anyone. Colleagues in the caution on this bill, just simply because it is a large bill, I'd like to hold the work session over until tomorrow and give you a further chance to look at the actual contents of the bill, the changes that are made, the legislative or the revenue impact statement, which even though the items are fairly small and fairly specific, do actually reduce state revenue, not in this biennium, but in the next two significantly. So let's hold this over, please, till tomorrow, and to give you a chance to look at it and be ready to be to involve yourself in the conversation in the work session. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4025, and we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 4072. And thank you very much. Thank you. 4072. Chris, do you want to give us an update and let's see what we have here?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4072 pertains to the University Venture Development Fund.
Right.
It makes a few changes to the program. It moves the sunset date for the contributions tax credit from January 1, 2016 to January 1, 2022. So it did sunset at the beginning of the year. It would increase the annual taxpayer credit cap from $50,000 to $600,000 and creates a three-year carry forward. The bill does maintain the existing program cap of $8.4 million but reorganizes how those the contributions and related tax credits would be allotted across the universities.
Very good. So let's hear from President Ray and your panel. It looks like there may be four of you. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz, members of the committee. We appreciate the press of time that you're dealing with, so we'll try to be as direct as possible. I'll let Brian Wall, who's here with me, and you two might identify yourselves for the committee as well.
And for the record, did you identify yourself?
Hey, Ed Ray, President of Oregon State University.
Thank you very much, sir.
Brian.
Brian Wall, Assistant Vice President, Oregon State University Research Office.
Welcome back.
Katie Fankhauser, Program Manager at SweetSense, Inc.
Great. Adrian Polyak, CEO of Dietomix.
Thank you. Good. All right.
Thanks. Thanks for having us back. Certainly appreciate your time on this. Last time I was here, we talked quite a bit about how the funding actually flowed and how it flowed into the impact and what the repayment provisions were and how that was working out. This time we're going to talk a little bit about what the leverage is and how this actually turns into success for the state. We've got certainly another company CEO to talk about their experience, an employee who's benefited from this, and certainly our president here to talk about the priority for the universities that are engaged. So in short, we've talked about this previously, but the intent when this was set up in 2007 was to provide an $8.4 million tax credit that had the ability to repay itself and regenerate tax credits well into the future. The commercialization timeline is a 10 to 12 year timeline. We're really halfway through. Once this got launched in 2007 and fundraising occurred, we're halfway through the initiative. So what we're asking for is an extension to show that the 10 to 12 year timeline does actually work, will actually produce the return for the state that we've been talking about. You've seen some of the numbers in terms of the 27 startup companies and several employees from those, as well as other impacts back in terms of revenues to the state. One thing I wanted to talk a little bit today about was just to say that, you know, this fund leverages over $700 million in research that occurs in the universities and provides the Valley of Death funding, which we've discussed previously, between research results and commercializations. The Kauffman Foundation and Institute for Competitiveness and Prosperity recently released a study about where new jobs come from. Their studies show over the last 25 years, almost all private sector jobs have been created by businesses less than 5 years old. And universities are doing a lot of heavy lifting in this area to significantly further leverage this tax credit. So the tax credit itself is not the only thing that comes to play when we're looking at spinning out companies out of the universities. And a couple of examples. Collectively, we focus pretty heavily on equity-based licensing. And so what that means for a university is we take on additional risk, where we'll protect intellectual property over a long time period, multiple countries, set a company up right without burdening them with significant upfront expenses. It allows a company to really to get going and finalize the development and attract the capital needed to get them up and running. The universities certainly utilize this tax credit to help with the development side, but we're also putting skin in the game by paying for the patent expenses and carrying those additional costs that can add up into several hundred thousand dollars for any given endeavor. As an example, nationwide, University of Wisconsin has somewhere around $1.2 billion in research on an annual basis. Collectively, the Oregon universities bring in about $700 million. Mm-hmm. Yet the Oregon universities are producing 2.5 times the number of startups than the University of Wisconsin. This tax credit, this particular endeavor, is one of the key linchpins as to how and why we're able to actually leverage that, and we're willing to put additional skin in the game by putting emphasis on equity-based licensing. We're also providing over $2 for every dollar that's put in through the RAIN organization or our accelerator, which again helps create startup companies and focusing them in the right path. So long of the short is, you know, really if the priorities of the state include, you know, a desire to have the creation of a significant number of highway jobs, attract outside capital for the state, there is absolutely no better leverage than this fund. And I'll turn it over to Ed, and then I'll...
Thank you, Brian. Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Bence, members of the committee, I'm really here to speak on behalf of all seven of the university presidents. We're very supportive of the University Venture Development Fund. What we're asking is for the hiccup that occurred at the end of the last session to be amended. This is a program. We're not asking for additional money beyond the original authorization. We're talking about a 5 to 10, 12-year horizon for this to play itself out. We're simply asking for the ability to continue forward with what we think has been a very effective program. The investments that we're talking about that are made possible through this a tax credit program are investments that commercial investors will not make. These are startup companies that enter what's sometimes called the Valley of Death, where you're going from concept to proof of concept. Everybody gets it when you get to proof of concept that maybe it's worth investing in. This allows startups to bridge that gap and get to the point where they can hopefully get commercial funding. We've had So far, about 4.8 million has been awarded in tax credits. We have another 3.5 million that could be
awarded if we get approval to continue this program forward. In the last 5 years, the estimate is that tax income generated from companies that were initiated through this process have already returned $4.35 million in income tax revenue to the state. So this is, unlike many tax credits, this is a program that, as companies succeed, revenues do get returned to pay for the tax credit that was granted in the first place. And we're very confident we'll be successful. Brian mentioned that there have been some 27 startups. There are more than 20 now that are still operating and effectively moving forward. Collectively, they've generated somewhere between 250 and 300 jobs. So they are serving the needs of the people of Oregon. We're always challenged to figure out how do we turn research efforts at the universities into benefits in terms of businesses and jobs and revenues for the state of Oregon. We think this program is working well. We have companies from fields as diverse as material science, computer engineering, green energy, biotech, pharmaceuticals, and various forms of manufacturing. To give you a sense of the broader context within which we're operating, I can speak to Oregon State's experience. Over about the last 5 or 6 years, and Brian has been a big part of the success, we've gone from generating about $1.8 million a year in licensing and royalty fees to $10.9 last year. We've gone from $23 million of university industry research partnerships to more than $42 million a year in such partnerships. This is a key piece of our ability to connect with industry and business at every level to leverage our efforts to be as successful as possible, and we hope that you'll be able to support the reinstatement of this program. It ended at the end of last session, but the enabling legislation didn't run out till the end of the calendar year, so people could make their take advantage of the tax credit in 2014. If you reinitiate it, people will be able to do the same during this calendar year, and I think we can sort of get back on stride and continue to provide value in response to the legislature's action. So let me turn it back over to Brian and others, unless you have questions.
Well, before we go on, I noticed that Representative Rayfield has come in, and I know he's got a time crunch. I need to know if you need to go now or if you can wait for a bit. Oh, that is even more convenient. All right. Please, go ahead.
Yeah, so
let me ask one question.
Yeah.
You said we several times, and you gave some numbers. Were you talking about Oregon State
and
University?
And that was just Oregon State,
statewide, for all of the universities, the numbers would be larger.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Thank you.
So that gives you a base to start from.
Sure. Maybe we could turn it over to a CEO of another company. We've had a few through.
And as long as the mic is close enough so we pick it up for our massive internet audience, we'll be happy to hear from him.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnard and Vice Chair Benz and the committee. Thanks so much for allowing me to speak to you today. I'm Adrian Polyak, CEO of Diatomics, which is a clean tech startup that was spun out of Portland State University exactly a year ago. This company has a very promising technology. It is a compound that actually self-cleans indoor air pollution. So it actually will actively decontaminate volatile organic compounds without having to be cleaned or reapplied. And the applications that are most obvious are in a paint slurry that paint manufacturers would apply to their products at the manufacturing source and then sold to schools, nursing homes, hospitals, hotels, and residences. Yeah. This is a big issue that a lot of us unfortunately don't know about because of the issues with the VOCs. They're carcinogenic, and they tend to affect us over many, many years. But in Europe and in Asia in particular, China for sure, this is a well-known issue, and the regulatory agencies and the consumers are really demanding reduced VOCs in their products and in their environments. The UVDF funds that we have just recently secured that will actually arrive this week to the company are instrumental. They are small in total dollars, but for us, they're substantial. By that, I mean we can actually do things immediately. In fact, just last week, we posted for 2 part-time technician positions. We've already received 7 applications. Once we get the funds in, which should be any day, literally any day, the check has been sent, we will make these hires and we'll get started with this work. Work has already been done, so the technology has already been demonstrated feasibility. There's no issue on that. What we're now doing is starting with product development activities for some of the paint partners that you will be aware of, Sherwin-Williams, Rota Paint, and PPG, Pittsburgh Paints, which are all global players. These companies are interested in this technology. They told us exactly what type of activity, what type of work they want to see demonstrated before they will engage with us in further business development discussions. Those prescribed activities we want to get started with right away. This is for sure a way to immediately allow us to do this. We have interest from investors. All of that's exciting, but that takes time. Due diligence on that front takes time. The UVDF process was actually quite rapid, and I think it's serving its purpose to allow a company like us to move forward very quickly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Barnhart and Vice Chair Benz and the rest of the committee for inviting me here today. Again, my name is Katie Fankhauser, and I'm a program manager at SweetSense, Inc., and I'm here to give an employee's perspective. SweetSense is a technology startup company located in Portland, Oregon, and also based on innovations developed at Portland State University. SweetSense provides dynamic, secure, rapid data through remote sensing for water, infrastructure, sanitation and hygiene, and energy applications in locales around the world. Our sensors have monitored safe drinking water consumption in Kenya, improved cook stove use in Rwanda, hand washing in Indonesia, and latrine habits in Bangladesh. Part of our unique service offering is customized data analysis and interpretation to inform policy, market research, and programmatic decisions. SweetSense was formed with a seed grant from the University Venture Development Fund in 2013. And since then, we have moved away from in-house assembly of the sensors and set up production and manufacturing in Salem. We have won contracts, improved capacity, and been able to access larger projects that require hundreds of sensors, which will further increase efficiencies and reduce costs. We currently provide services to 3 internationally recognized clients and continue to support research functions as we look to expand to other applications, such as agriculture and countries, including Ethiopia. And currently, SweetSense employs 9 Oregonians. The initial seed grant from the UVDF was critical to the company's formation, and it is likely that without the funds, the company would not have been successful, or at the very least would have been much slower in gaining crucial momentum. In fact, I probably wouldn't be here today if it weren't for the growth SweetSense has experienced in the last 3 years. I was hired by SweetSense only last month, but have known the team longer than this in other roles. And I can say they certainly have undergone a transformation in scale, adding capacity and professionalism to the business. My position as program manager in particular was created out of the need to manage a diverse client base while balancing growing administrative, technical, and field operations, as well as helping to recruit new partnerships. My passion is in international development, providing basic human rights to disadvantaged populations. SweetSense is allowing me to realize these goals while staying in Oregon. My involvement with their team supports my return to graduate school for a master's in public health at Oregon Health and Science University, while retaining focus on practical application of my studies. I originally hail from Kansas, but moved to Oregon 2 years ago. Here, SweetSense has provided opportunities for career development and academic advancement in an environment of dedicated professionals. I believe the initial UVDF had a true impact for SweetSense, which in turn has encouraged the wider development sector in Oregon and impacted thousands of lives across the globe. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is our expert panel, colleagues. Now's the time to ask questions. Yes, we'll talk. Start with Representative Nose. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is more for staff. Is this just a one-time allocation that we're making? Is that how this works? It's not.
It's kind of a revolving cap. There's a program cap of $8.4 million, And that $8.4 million is kind of an outstanding debt to the general fund. So they can issue tax credits up to $8.4 million. But as there is a part of the program is a repayment to the general fund, and as the general fund is reimbursed, that creates additional room under that cap for the additional, for the issuance of additional tax credits.
All right, so I'm going to say this back to you another way, so see if I'm understanding it. So it's basically, it's an $8 million general fund reduction that over time, if they're successful, we can reduce that because they're replenishing it. Is that another way to describe it?
Right. Now, the 8.4 right now, they about half of that has been issued. So okay. The potential revenue impact, I haven't put together an official revenue impact statement here.
Okay.
But there's about $4 million left under the cap. So the question, depending on how things move forward, the revenue impact in statement would show a direct revenue loss of $4 million somehow over the next 6 years. Because right now about half of that has been issued in tax credits.
So it's not an annual $8 million. It's $4 million over the life
total
of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And maybe we incur $1 million in this fiscal year, and the next year only half a million, and so on and so on.
Correct.
And that's kind of the general estimate, representative. Be about $1 million a year in grants. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Right. Yes. Representative Pence, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the presentation and taking the time to be here. Is there, it's been said in front of our committee over the years I've been on it, that we're good at starting up businesses here but not so good at keeping them, and that as we reach a mid-management point where we have more middle managers, they get impatient with paying our, shall we say, robust income tax, and they leave. And so that means that the investment at the front end that we're now talking about is lost. I guess the question is, what's been your experience? Is this just a myth that I'm repeating?
Well, speaking specifically to this program, and Brian could give you more specifics, this was enacted in 2005, made functional in 2007. Then we had the Great Recession. You may remember not a lot of people were looking for tax credits. So the history of people applying for these, taking advantage of tax credits is really within the 4 or 5 year range. So we really haven't run this long enough to have businesses have enough opportunity to grow to see, so what are the next set of challenges that they face? Are they going to stay here and continue to generate jobs and revenue? But we do have an estimate that just in the last 5 years, through the jobs created, 250 to 300, and the income generated, that they've returned $4.35 million to the state in new tax revenues. So I think we're confident that the state's going to get a good rate of return on the $8 million revolving fund. The bigger issue that we face as a state of how do we keep businesses that are successful here is something I think you and I even could spend a day or two talking about, all the forces at play. But we feel good about the way it's been playing out to this point for this program.
Thank you. If I could also just respond to that.
Please, yes.
Mr. Benz, it's a great question. And in Diatomic's case in particular, our business model has called out a production facility to be built right here in Oregon. Since the supply chain of the raw materials comes from the state as well. One of the key ingredients is diatomaceous earth, which is prevalent in the mines out in eastern Oregon. So for many reasons, that being one of them, it makes perfect sense to stay here. And this goes all the way out. There's no reason why we have to lift and go elsewhere. Secondly, the actual manufacturing process is relatively affordable, so you're not relying on a huge component of labor, which might be a big component down the road in terms of margins for channel partners down the road. And then I would say myself and a lot of other executives are keen to have production remain here in Oregon. I came from a company prior that produced here in the state where we easily could have gone to China because of some of the commodity aspects of the products and chose not to, and instituted programs like lean manufacturing and so forth. There's so many benefits to that, including overseeing your quality control and being able to be flexible with what you put on the lines and so forth. So I think there's a trend nationally, which I hope will continue, of bringing back manufacturing back into the U.S. for U.S. companies.
Please. Yeah.
Well,
It's a great opportunity that you've provided me with mentioning the diatomaceous earth plant just outside of where I grew up. But the interesting thing about it is it's located on a school section of land. And so when you buy that from the plant, EP Minerals, that some of that money comes right back to, well, schools.
From school plant.
Yeah, so about $500,000 a year is thrown off of that one section of land back to our schools. So it's a great opportunity for me to mention mining as something other than a dirty word. Which it seems to have become.
That's really interesting because EP Minerals is actually one of the vendors we buy through.
Right.
And that's the other benefit you get from this. You get indirect benefit to EP, the community there, and so forth, the secondary benefits.
Thank you.
Thank you. The president indicated that, at Oregon State at least, they help pay for intellectual property protection and a few other things that are part of the startup process. I'm assuming that as an experienced businessman, all of those things have been taken care of as you get on with your trials.
That's correct. I mean, we just filed for our patent in November of 2015.
So it's pending.
It's pending, which is critical. But I will say that even though the company will bear those expenses, Portland State has been instrumental in terms of essentially bearing those costs until we can afford to pay for them. And in addition to that, providing us with IP representation, legal representation, that we otherwise couldn't obtain. So their connections, their ability to put us in front of really outstanding, probably top attorneys that know this particular area of chemistry was very helpful.
Great. So you got other support from the university that you would otherwise have to pay for.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Critical for a startup that has no money.
It's absolutely critical, especially at this very, very early stage.
Yeah.
I mean, it's often what allows a company to move forward or stall.
Thank you. Representative Whitson?
Yes. I just wanted to congratulate, I think, and note that many of us read last week about Oregon State and the advancements being made in ALS research.
Yes.
And hopefully a cure down there. And so I suppose that some of these sorts of monies could go to startups that incorporate, the advancements that you're making there in medical technology.
Thank you, Representative Whitson. Yes, I think, as the one example here about, not only local but global impacts for good that some of these spin-outs are able to obtain, a lot of the work that we're doing is in areas like ALS, MS research, other areas where there could be extraordinary benefits to society. We are interested in our ability, as are all of our colleagues at the other universities, to serve as engines of economic growth and social progress, but improving the human condition is something we're all very dedicated to, and much of the work that does result because of the focus of aspects of university research does have kind of that social dimension that you might not find in a typical research lab somewhere that isn't purposed quite the way the public universities are to serve the people.
Okay. Yep, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you all for your testimony. Can you talk about the value of being able to offer this tax credit in addition to a tax deduction? I mean, clearly any donor can make a contribution to any of the public universities and receive a deduction under the general charitable provisions. So what's the boost that this provides? And I don't see it referenced in that sheet, but it is a 60% tax credit, right? So for each dollar, we're talking about 60 cents back in the form of a tax credit.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Davis. So we work hand in hand with our foundation to fundraise for this, and I'm not an expert in fundraising, but I have met with several donors to raise the amount that OSU has, and the importance for them is they'll generally, what we're finding is donors will donate to OSU for certain endeavors. But this is viewed as kind of an on-the-top contribution. And so we haven't had a lot of success in raising directly, specifically for this, without something in addition to it. And so we have a lot of discussions with the foundation about how do we go about and really go forward to raise the rest of this rounds. We've been pretty successful with it. OSU has raised just over 3 million tax, or provided over 3 million tax credits. And again, the donors seem to have, A, the passion for the area because they see the value on it, but B, I think it's the tax credit that actually allows them the ability to kind of pull the trigger and say, yes, we're in for a significant addition to what else we've been thinking about.
Follow-up for staff. Chris, how does this compare? I mean, I know it's unique to each taxpayer, but to the extent that we can generalize, how does this compare to a general charitable deduction? I mean, for effective tax that would be paid by a middle, or we'd really be looking at folks probably towards the upper end of the spectrum who'd be utilizing this.
Well, the big difference is the tax credit's a dollar for dollar,
mm-hmm.
and the deduction would be, just if you focus on the top end folks, the 9.9%, so rounding that to 10%.
Mm-hmm.
So a $1,000 deduction would be worth $100, whereas the tax credit takes that $1,000 and it's a $600 tax credit,
mm-hmm.
to try and normalize that comparison. So the key there is the deduction is income that is no longer taxable, so the benefit is you're not applying the tax rate to that.
Mm-hmm.
And the tax credit is just a dollar per dollar reduction of those taxes.
Thank you.
And of course that doesn't consider the effect on federal tax returns. Could you describe that to us if you know?
The deduction would for the $1,000 contribution, the amount that they don't get the tax credit for would be deducted at the federal level as a charitable contribution. And then the tax credit just applies to the Oregon taxes.
Okay. So it's something like 3/4 of the contribution for a high-income person would be money that would in effect be returned by one or by two different tax collectors, the state of Oregon for 60% and the federal government for another 15 or so.
Yes, or more depending on the tax rate. If we're talking high-end folks, it would be 25% or...
Okay.
Or, yeah.
We're talking about the percentage of the 40% that's left, right?
Yes.
That's why
yes.
I was thinking
yes.
about 15%.
Yes. yes.
So that ends up about 75% versus... doing the same numbers, about half.
Correct.
If we were simply dealing with a deduction on both returns.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, doing this quickly in my head, that's what I come up with anyway. Okay. Other questions, Representative?
Thank you.
No? Others? You use other funds than the funds in this account to help support these startups, don't you?
Yes.
What percentage or what part of those funds is this account that we've been discussing, and how important is that? How do we evaluate the importance of that as a bootstrap or as in a supplemental funding or whatever?
Sure.
The reason I ask is because we are always broke.
Yep.
Just like you are, and we have to work really hard to allocate the dollars we have to the things that are absolutely the most important. So that's what motivates this question.
All right. Mr. Chair, thanks for the question. I think there's a fair amount of complexity that goes into any endeavor like this, as you might imagine. The typical route would be a faculty member would receive federal funding, maybe a couple $100,000, up to maybe $500,000 over a 3 to 5 year period before something really kind of tangible comes of it that shows some success. And the typical path at that point would be for faculty to publish and then move on and propose some additional funds. The UVDF steps in at the tail end of that, looks at, we have primarily an external advisory council, looks at that and makes the funding recommendations on which markets to target that research towards. The other components within the university include, intellectual property licensing office, which have professionals that are well-versed in how to protect intellectual property, how to work with the attorneys, licensing professionals, how to negotiate licenses effectively, create equity agreements that benefit the startup companies. and then, you know, negotiate and execute basically the entire package that's needed for a startup to then take that endeavor and move it forward. Our office, the office that I manage, one of them underneath me, we are in the 90% self-sustaining category. And so we've been able to do this, the growth that President Ray talked about, through other endeavors where we've had licenses with large-scale companies that are paying revenues in. We're turning those around and using those to benefit these startup companies. We're also investing those back into, we launched our OSU Advantage Accelerator and collaborating with RAIN, we're turning around investing those monies back in to be able to pull those things together as well. And the whole intent out of all of these things are to try to find those critical areas of research that have significant public impact and leverage the dollars, every source we have, to be able to start these companies and grow them in Oregon. Because for me, full cycle is the number one win, and not just for the state, but for OSU. We've seen companies that we've gone down this process with who have gotten the investments, started selling product and services, and then turn around and continue to start researching with OSU. And so they'll be providing research grants and opportunities and hiring students. So the better we can form these relationships from the beginning, the better I think it is for everybody.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Let me try a metaphor on you and see if this makes sense. It occurs to me that your organization is very much like a startup itself. You're reinvesting constantly in the next thing with the dollar as it flows in. And if more dollars flowed in, you would be able to either invest better, more in the things that ought to have more, or in a larger variety of things, if I understand that correctly.
That's absolutely accurate.
I mean, in that sense, you're like a startup company that takes every dollar it makes on a product and sticks it in to building the next factory.
Correct.
All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Other questions for this panel? I want to thank you all very much for coming today, especially President Ray, who I know is very busy, and appreciate the fact that you represent your colleagues.
Thank you very much. And if I can be allowed a moment of personal privilege.
Please.
I said earlier today in a meeting, nobody runs for office to cut everybody's budget. You're all living in difficult times. A lot of us do not take that for granted. We really applaud your service and understand you have to make hard decisions. And we advocate as best we can for those things where most responsible for, but we really respect and appreciate your being in the arena, putting yourself up for public review, and then serving in these kinds of difficult circumstances. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. I have one other person signed up today to testify, Jody Weiser, if you'll come forward. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? Jody.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Jody Weiser, testifying for Tax Fairness Oregon. So I want to start with just a big question that Rep. Davis raised, because we do wonder why this system was set up with tax credits, because anybody else donating to the university, whether they're endowing a chair or creating a fund to do scholarships or building a building on a campus, gets a donation receipt. They use the tax code to help support that donation they made, and that's how we do it with our other efforts. And so we're curious about why we have this particular mechanism for this particular fund. That said, we're pleased that this year they're coming and asking for a continuation of the amount they originally were offered, $8.4 million, rather than the $25 million that they were here asking for last year. It's a big difference in the ask from what it was. The bill does just extend the sunset until 2022. However, it makes some changes that are quite beneficial to the donors, because right now it's a 3-year tax credit. You have to divide the use of it over 3 years. So the time value of money is quite different when you can use the tax credit all in 1 year. It's also quite beneficial because I know last year that I sold a stock and had a lot of appreciation, and that I will have a heavy tax bill this year. So I could donate to this fund and know I was going to be able to use the full tax credit. I don't know whether I would need, would have any tax liability in the next 2 years after that to use a tax credit. So it would seem that if we are making the, if we follow the what they asked for and make the benefit to the donor better, then we should be able to reduce the benefit from 60 to 55% because we've sweetened the deal for the donor. As a person that who could enter into one of these agreements, that's a, it's a way more confident place for me. My taxes go from $60,000 to zero, and then to $80,000, and then to $12,000 or something. They jump all over the place. So I don't know what they're going to be in year two or three, but I do know what they're going to be in the year that things are happening. And so it is a quite a nice additional gift to the taxpayer. The other thing I would say is that with this program and the IDA program, we are not being really clear about the what donations are being made. When I get earn interest at my bank, I get a 1099 form that says that I earned $50.83 this year. And the bank has to administer that. They have to send me the form, and they send it to the IRS and the DOR as well. We're giving out tax credits under this bill that could be as much as $600,000 a year to a single person or business. And yet there really isn't paperwork that goes to the IRS that says we gave them $600,000 in benefit for their $1 million donation. And when I've looked at I have not seen the paperwork that goes with these from the university. But when I've looked at what is coming for IDAs, it's clear about how to handle things at the state level. It's pretty mushy about how to handle things at the federal level. And so if you say at the federal level, I made $1 million donation, you get quite a benefit, about 36%. And then you get a 60% benefit from the state in the way of a tax credit. You're not really making a donation. You're just moving money around. And so it seems to me that it's time for us to be very clear and to notify the IRS when we're giving people tax credits that are worth this kind of money. And that, those are really the two notes that I wanted to make that haven't already been made.
Thank you very much. Questions for Jody Weiser? I appreciate those suggestions. I think they're both of them are useful. I'm not sure how to implement the second one, but the first one is something we can certainly do by statute here.
And the second one we could probably do by statute by creating the format that we expect the letter to go out in, at least. But it may also be that this may require a dialogue with the IRS. How do you want us to notify you? Do you, because it isn't quite 1099 income.
No.
But they must want notification.
The IRS wants a letter from the charity indicating that you've given money and that you haven't received any goods or services in return.
Right.
And I think your suggestion, if I understand it, is that that letter would also include a statement that this qualifies for a 60% Oregon tax credit on this amount.
I think it
would. And then the IRS would have to figure out what that meant.
Right. Well, I think you would say that you received $1 million donation and you've delivered $600,000 worth of benefit.
Right.
Because that's what you've done.
Right. Thank you.
And so that it would be that clear instead of saying it kind of wishy-washy.
Thank you very much. Other questions for Jody? That's a great suggestion, by the way. And I've already asked if other people wanted to be heard, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4072. Are we ready to go on with the EITC bills? I think we are, aren't we? You ready?
All right.
We'll open the public hearings then. These two bills have similar issues, so we're going to open them together. Open the public hearing on House Bill 4120 and House Bill 4110.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I put two documents into OLIS. One of them is titled Earned Income Tax Credit 2015. That's just a basic primer for any of the new members who aren't familiar with how the Earned Income Tax Credit works. The other handout, Earned Income Tax Credit Bills, is a summary of the two bills before you, 4110 and 4120, and the amendments within those bills. I'll just touch briefly on the introduced version since you're about to get some testimony on the changes. They basically increase the percentage of, under current law, the Oregon EIC is 8% of the federal credit. The bills in a couple of different formats increase that percentage for certain taxpayers and would apply to the next 3 or 4 years. And then the one exception, there is a dash one to 4110 that relates to property taxes.
Great. Who would like to go first?
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, committee, thank you so much for having us here today to hear this. Mr. Chair, I'm very happy to hear that your comment earlier about the need to allocate limited resources very carefully, because I think this is exactly what this bill does. I know that some of you may be familiar with the Earned Income Tax Credit. I'd like to kind of review some of the benefits of it, and there will be other testimony coming up that will get into some of the other details about it. But just as a way of introduction, this is a Earned Income Tax Credit started 40 years ago at the federal level, and it actually started as an economic development policy. And the idea was to allow people to keep just a little bit more of their money, those that are in poverty, and because they're very likely to spend that money back in their own communities and therefore help grow the local economy. And it's actually worked. It's turned out that it does encourage people to work and rewards that work. It incents people to leave public assistance a little bit sooner and actually remain employed. And it encourages people to increase work hours to take advantage of the Earned Income Tax Credit because they can see the rewards. And there's been a lot of studies done on it. I'll give you just a few of the results. Mothers who receive the credit are less likely than other low-income mothers to smoke before and after pregnancy, more likely to eat healthy diets and deliver babies at healthy birth weights. And children of these families that receive the credit score better on math and reading tests than low-income families who do not receive the credit. The same children go on to earn actually 17% more money when they reach adulthood. And they also are contributing more, so they actually have an improved Social Security picture when they reach retirement. So a broad range of benefits from this one very simple policy. Oregon did increase the credit slightly in 1997, and Oregonians today get an additional 8% of their federal Earned Income Tax Credit. But we need to do some more. Oregon still has more citizens living in poverty than during the height of the recession. 1 in 5 of our children are living in poverty. And I don't think our work is done. So I'm proposing this modest increase. I've been told to ask for approximately $10 million. And with that, we can't do it all for everybody that needs it. But what we can do is take that $10 million and really focus it on those that need it the most. And so I'm suggesting that we target the families with children under 2 years of age, and that would increase their amount of their credit from 8% to 11%. That's money that will mean a lot to if you're in need and you get a little bit extra in your tax refund. I don't know of any other tax credit that we have. You guys are the experts on all the tax credits, but I really can't I would challenge you to think, is there anything else that's going to, A, help folks in poverty, and B, help our communities at the same time? And I think it goes hand in hand with other discussions that we're having at this time during this very exciting session to help people work their way out of poverty. And I'll stop right there.
Bravo. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill. The concept has just been explained. My reason for bringing the bill had to do with my desire to present the EITC as a contrast, if you will, to the increases in the minimum wage. And the idea was to point out that when it comes to how we're going to help folks at this particular income level, the EITC studies indicate is the better way to do it, or at least a really good way to do it in addition to an appropriate minimum wage. The reason I put one of these in front of you was to, first of all, give me myself an opportunity to thank our Legislative Revenue Office for creating this chart. I've shown this at I don't know how many town hall meetings now because it's such a great illustration of how little a person, a single parent with two kids, actually ends up with as the minimum wage goes up. And that's to be contrasted to this EITC approach, which, of course, puts dollars directly in those people's pockets. It, of course, encourages work, which is something we truly want to do. And it's a great way of getting money to people if you're looking at the types of systems we use when it comes to direct cash transfers. Because most of you know that our system of moving funds from those who have money to those who don't, most of the time are managed through a bureaucracy that takes about 85% of the money. Mm. So studies indicate that something less than 20% actually makes it to the people that need it, and other people take their share of it on its way toward them. This program is far better. I really like this chart because this shows exactly what I just said. If we get these folks an increase in the minimum wage, nothing sifts down to the bottom line. And so now I did not know exactly how much this 1% would amount to, so I can't really say how much per person this would amount to. It's not a huge amount, but it has the merit of being shared when it comes to the burden by all taxpayers, as opposed to the minimum wage, which of course is shared by the employer, or actually borne by the employer. So I think it's a great contrast, and I don't know how much our budget will allow us to utilize in the two different programs we've suggested, but I would certainly support something.
Very good. Questions? Yes, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both. I think it's great that you have come at these in different ways, and I look forward to working with you all to figure out kind of the best way to implement this. I have to ask Representative Benz, could you explain what you mean about the difference in the way that these benefits are, the cost of how EITC is so much more direct than some unnamed other benefits with an 80% overhead?
Right.
I was trying to understand what you were referring to, and I did not.
Well, I just had that conversation with my colleague here at the DIAS. I subscribe to an unusually large number of magazines and periodicals and commentary magazines.
That does not surprise me.
No.
Has a wonderful article, which I'd love to share with you, reflecting studies that show exactly what I just said. I think it's around 16%, but I'm going to say something less than 20. And it's based actually upon something that Senator Monahan said many, many years ago, where he equated the bureaucracy to a horse. And we would feed money into one end of the horse, and the people who were trying to reach would receive what came out the other end. And
What a lovely analogy.
Yes, well, I'm quoting the senator, so my analogy. But the point is the folks that we're trying to help are being robbed by the horse, or in this case, the bureaucracy. So I'll get you that study, and you can take a look at it. Now, when it comes to the EITC, the idea there, of course, is quite simple. Those that all of us taxpayers pay into the taxes will have part of that money taken in the form of these refundable credits, if you will. Chris can give us the right word for it, where the money actually makes its way directly to the people in the form of the refund being greater than that which they actually would be otherwise entitled to under what they earned. So it's a direct cash transfer. I have to be careful here, but whoever's preparing their taxes may well take a share of it, and that's why I think we see so much advertising this time of year by various folks trying to get their hands on some of the EITC. Mm-hmm. And we've discussed in the past how we need to approach that particular situation to make sure that folks aren't being taken advantage of when it comes to receiving those monies.
briefly follow?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Okay. And just as a brief follow, so I would just say, however, that if one of if part of the example is, for example, somebody getting health benefits from OHA, mm-hmm. and that having a higher benefit, well, I would say, well, of course, because you're paying for them, for you're establishing the healthcare system, and then they're getting the benefit. And indeed, there would be a much a significantly higher overhead if that is one of the benefits that you would talk about. I think it's not entirely a fair, not an unfair equation, but it's very different structurally. The benefit you're trying to give somebody through healthcare, or through through TANF, through SNAP.
So, if I may, because this is a really interesting issue, I'll get you the study. The assertion made is that those interest groups that support the organizations that cater to the poverty-stricken are so powerful that figuring out how to manage income inequality with those in between the money and the need is impossible. That's the conclusion reached by the authors of the article. And so what we should be doing is looking at our programs and saying, how good a job are we doing in having those programs actually achieve the purpose, or are we just creating jobs for folks, paying them, and then a few pennies make their way through to the people that need the help? And so that article does go through those programs pretty well. Happy to get a copy of it. Happy to give it to the committee.
Thank you.
Good. Yes.
May I make just one or
please,
two other,
Reardon, yes.
additional comments, if I may?
Yeah.
I don't want you to think that I have just, randomly leaped on this idea of doing the 3% additional, that wasn't the only thing we looked at. If you look at the cost of increasing, say, for all recipients of the earned income tax credit, and increasing that by 1%, each 1% roughly $6.5 to $7 million for every percent if you peanut butter across the for everybody. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to take the 10 and try to ratchet it up, where it would really make a significant difference to fewer people, but it's really are those folks that need it the most. The other thing we looked at, and I don't want to get over my head here, I just want to mention this, is you could also help people by changing the tax code. And right now, people that are earning as low as $8,150 are paying the same rate as somebody making $125,000. So, that could be played with as well. I'm not proposing that, just mentioning it for background and comparison. Again, that would be a very broad brush approach. This is a very targeted approach, going back to that idea, using our limited resources as effectively as we can.
Thank you. So there is another bill in this committee that approaches that issue. I'm not sure it's the right approach, but it's there. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And let's go ahead with our panels. I'm not certain whether the people signed up in the order in which they really want to talk or not. And what I think I'm going to do is make some panels and make some guesses. And then hopefully we'll get everybody through quickly. How about John Mullen, Tyler McInnes, and Marcia Kelly? Yeah, and if you could keep it down to a couple of minutes or 3 minutes or so, that would be extremely helpful. I'd like to get everybody through in 35 minutes if we can. This is our last piece, isn't it? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. Our mission is to achieve justice for Oregon's low-income communities. I want to point out that the legal aid community was really involved in the advocacy that created the first effort of having a state earned income tax credit. We were among the states that did not have a state earned income tax credit to begin with. I also need to apologize for an error in my testimony. I inadvertently put House Bill 4144 in my opening sentence. That's also an earned income tax credit bill. That's Representative Kenny Geyer's bill about outreach and participation. And I would just say that I'm very pleased this session that we're having a discussion, very focused discussion on the earned income tax credit. Back in 2015, I participated in the work that Representative Kenny Geyer led about combining the working family tax credit and the child independent credit, which wound up as an omnibus tax credit bill that you all worked on, House Bill 2171, in the last session. The reason that I point that out is that one of the issues that we left on the table was a discussion about adjusting the earned income tax credit and doing essentially what Representative Reardon's bill does. And so I think that you'll hear from a number of other people about the value of targeting families that have young children. As I like to say to my colleagues that are having children for the first time, I say, don't worry, it doesn't change a thing. Because obviously it really does change everything, everything from childcare to nutrition to transportation and so forth. So I think the targeting of young children really does make some sense. In closing, I just say that I also appreciate the fact that Representative Bentz brought forward a bill, and going to 9% for everybody is also a policy worth while of consideration. The only thing that I would say about Representative Bentz's bill that creates some difficulty is the monthly distribution. The logistics of that would be difficult.
Let's let him interrupt for a second.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you are absolutely right. I have an amendment that takes that out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I should have mentioned during my testimony. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And with that, I'll just conclude my testimony and urge support for House Bill 4110. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tyler McInnes. I'm with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. Happy to join my colleagues here today in support of boosting the earned income tax credit. Also want to extend my appreciation to Representatives Reardon and Representative Bentz for their interest in this issue. In the meeting materials, you should find a few submissions from me. One in particular is a fact sheet on the impacts of the EITC in Oregon. Just to share a couple figures with you briefly, when taken together with the federal child tax credit, the earned income tax credit helped lift 129,000 Oregonians and 65,000 children out of poverty on average between 2011 and 2013. And we know this is one of the most effective anti-poverty tools at our disposal. And in 2012 alone, the EITC brought in over $586 million in federal money. And we at the center think that there's another 124 waiting on the table if we can get more folks who are eligible to file and claim their EITC. So we're here in support of House Bill 4110 and the increase of the increased portion in 4120. The research does show that there's great benefits to the children and families who receive the EITC. So we're happy to be here in support.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Marcia Kelly here as the co-chair of the HISCO Tax and Revenue Committee. HISCO has had a longstanding support of the EITC, and so we're, again, very happy that it's come forward because, as Representative Bentz did mention, we think that it's a really good incentive for making work pay and help. By helping people who are working but who are still struggling, it incurs that incentive. The targeting for small children, I think, is very, very smart. I don't have kids, but I was involved in helping some refugees resettle to Salem this last week. And I spent $160 on car seats because the kids, two-year-olds, had to get back from the Portland airport. And I discovered that was a real bargain compared to what some other places charge for car seats. Costco was great for that one. But those sorts of expenses are really can really stretch a starting family's budget. And so the targeting is just really appreciated. Representative Bentz's bill would give a small increase to all people, but dependent upon what the resources are, the targeting for the small children, I think, would be the most important thing. Again, HISCO has had longstanding support of the earned income tax credit and other things that will help people bring out of poverty.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Leininger, please.
You know, I think both of these bills are really important, and I think it's great that this panel is here. And I'd like to throw out the idea that in the spirit of showing the kind of teamwork that we in the legislature are able to do in a bipartisan way, it would be great to see Representative Benz and Representative Reardon be able to reach a middle ground compromise that you two could co-chief sponsor, that a lot of us could unite around. So thanks.
Thank you for the comment. Other comments, questions for this panel? I think we've heard from Marcia Kelly about the her comparison between the two bills. I wonder if either of the two of you would have a, other two of you would have a comment on that question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I said at the end of my testimony that I really appreciated the fact that Representative Benz brought his bill forward with the idea of taking out the distribution issue. I think it's very worthy of consideration. And along with what Representative Leininger just said, is if there's a way to do both, of course, advocates would love that.
Thank you.
And I got would a, echo the
I got a head nod. Yeah, I got it. Thanks. Other questions for this panel? Thank you so much. Appreciate your conservation of our time and so we can get everybody in. Philip Kennedy Wong, Matt Newell, Ching. Let's hear from those two. Or it looks,
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee for record, Philip Kennedy Wong, representing Oregon Food Bank. I'm actually honored to be joined by another colleague with a hyphenated last name. I think there's only a few of us in here. And he's also like half Asian, but I'm full Asian, so. Anyway, I wanted to take the opportunity to explain, you know, the work of the Oregon Food Bank network. And, you know, what we do obviously requires a lot of resources. And what we found is, you know, in our various business relationships and volunteering and donations, so on and so forth, is that charity alone does not end hunger. We also know that government programs alone doesn't end hunger. And all the private great work that's been happening alone, unfortunately, doesn't end hunger. So it takes a lot of different approaches. And for us, when we look at the Earned Income Tax Credit, we see it as a very effective tool, certainly. And you know, there are other avenues as well on the income side of the equation. And I know you guys are in the midst of a big debate on one of them. But I wanted to share that with you, but also at the same time give you a sense, being someone that has two kids that are, let's see, been out of daycare for 4 or 5 years, and I don't have to worry about buying diapers, but just to give you a sense of the cost, because it's amazing how expensive, you know, a lot of the things that we take for granted, what it requires for someone to raise kids. And I'm sure some of you know that experience, but I was looking at my old, you know, daycare center, and we have two kids, and, you know, their monthly charge is $1,355 just for one person, one child, which is a lot of money. And, you know, when you add on top of that, I recently looked up what it costs, what the average amount of dollars a family of four would have to spend on groceries. And I came across a USDA sort of chart, and it, you know, it showed a range from $563 a month to roughly $1,000 a month. So having said all of that, I certainly think when you look at the opportunity with the EITC, we would, you know, definitely support, whether it's targeted for families with small children or, you know, open to all tax filers that would be eligible. You know, we certainly would be very supportive of either steps. And my quick math, because I remember Rep. Reardon said $10 million, the dash two of the House Bill 4110 is $3.5 million, and the dash one of and the House Bill 4120 with the dash ones is $7 million, so that's pretty close. $10.5 million.
Some of which is an overlap.
Correct. Yeah. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Matt Newell Ching, Public Affairs Director with Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon. We come in support of both bills, 4110 and, as amended, 4120. My colleagues have given excellent testimony about the benefits of the Earned Income Tax Credit, so I'll just piggyback on a couple of points. One is that, and Representative Reardon chatted about this a little bit, in his proposal it targets families with kids that are up to, that have yet to hit their second birthday to address some of the unique costs there. And part of the reasoning for that is that, part of our core mission statement is to advocate for family economic stability and making sure the families have stability. We know that a happy, healthy, early childhood is the foundation for success in life. There's a wealth of research that shows that what happens in the first 1,000 days, from conception to age 2, has such profound effects on a child's well-being, not only through childhood, but through the adult years. Correlations to doing well in school, doing well in work. So these investments are wise. Oregon would be the first that we're aware of state that would do consider an earned income tax credit match for families with very young kids. We also support the move to 9%. Right now we're at 8%. I do want to issue, and I'm mindful of the financial constraints under which this committee has right now. I also just kind of want to issue a challenge as an advocate. There are other states that have even higher rates of match. Iowa, for example, has a 15% match. Kansas has a 17% match. New Jersey is a 30% match. So we could be like that other state that where you can't pump your own gas, aiming for 30%, just like New Jersey. That would be wonderful. So I think these are very good steps in the right direction, and we hope that in future years we consider moving that even higher to get families back on their feet. Thank you.
Right. Questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. Very much appreciate your testimony today. Jess Daly, John Tapagna.
John had to leave.
We'll hear from. Is there anyone else? We have a panel that wants to talk about the Dash One Amendment, which is on a slightly different topic, but is there anyone else who wants to talk about the main bills today? Because if there is, now's the time. I guess you're up.
Guess I'm all up. Thank you, Chair Barnhart and Representative Bentz, for having me and the committee. My name is Jessica Daly. I'm a Master's of Public Policy candidate at the Hatfield School of Government at PSU. I also have a background in early childhood education. I'm very pleased to see this timely and important issue has come to the attention of the legislator. Cost in early childhood care and education are increasing to levels on par with university tuition. I've been researching the EITC in various capacities for the better part of the last year for various organizations. And the EITC is a powerful tool, and the small increases proposed here today have the potential to bring more than their weight back to the state and federal dollars. In 2014, the federal EITC brought over $570 million into Oregon, and we're only claiming at 73% of those who qualify claim the credit. It's estimated, as Tyler said, that we're leaving about $124 million on the table for those 100,000 families. The EITC is found to reduce poverty overall. Specifically, half of the children whose families claim the EITC are lifted out of poverty. It was shown to relieve stress and mental health-related issues, especially for single mothers. Pregnant women who receive the EITC are less likely to have low birth weights, and therefore the EITC is assumed to alleviate later developmental problems that can be a result of low birth weights. An increase in the EITC is also associated with lower rates of abortion. The research suggests that this is due to less pregnancies caused by a change in sexual behavior, not an increase in births. 60% of EITC claims go to single filers with children. Notably, children of color whose parents received the EITC experience a 30% reduction in poverty levels. There was an important study done recently, it's 2014, I believe, the National Center for Children in Poverty at the Columbia University examined issues in states like Oregon. They recommend substantially increasing EITC for families living in poverty who are most adversely affected by aging or inconsistent tax codes. The EITC is the only mechanism in place that can really adjust the tax burdens of those in Oregon who are living below the federal poverty line. Unfortunately, the income brackets in Oregon haven't been adjusted since 1987. As inflation increases, as it has almost doubled since that time, this places an increasingly disproportionate burden, not just on low-income workers, but also on their children. Oregon is only one in five states that experience this phenomenon. The adverse effects of poverty on very young children may be more intense developmental consequences than on older children. School readiness studies at Harvard found that EITC and a similar Canadian credit have multiple positive impacts on child academic achievement, and this includes both academic and social achievement. The impact seems to increase the earlier in life the child receives the credit. Oregonians are critically underutilizing the EITC. Some states, like Minnesota and Wisconsin, use tiered systems that provide higher percentages to families and individuals with young children. These states experience higher utilization rates, both hovering around 70 to 80%. Among states with a refundable credit, the average value is 21.3% of the federal credit. Thank you for this chance to share some of this information about the myriad of benefits offered by the EITC.
Just stay right there just for a second. Are there questions for Jess? We were just checking to see if we have your testimony. You've got a lot of numbers in it. I want to make sure we've actually got it.
They're all cited. And you do have a copy over here.
Okay. All right. Good. I don't see it on my list, but it may be that it's simply out of date. Simply one correction to your testimony. The brackets in the statute may not have changed since 1987. But we have indexed them since 1993, so those do change every year as the cost of living increases. Indeed. Those brackets actually increase a little bit each year.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. And now, colleagues, we're going to shift gears, and we're going to ask for John Phillips, a name I can't read. It looks like Schmidt, maybe? And Randy, another name I can't read, who are going to come up and, old hands, who think I can read scribbles, both of them. They're going to talk about a different topic, which happens to fit the relating clause and is therefore related to the -1 amendment to House Bill 4110. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips, and I'm not with the Department of Revenue. I'm representing the Association of County Assessors now, and I wrote those names, so I apologize for the scribbles. I don't write them very often. Randy Walruff is with the Multnomah County. He's the assessor, and Doug Schmidt is Polk County Assessor.
So, welcome in your new role.
Well, thank you very much. A little bit of a familiar topic.
And I probably will make that mistake again.
Okay. I have four quick points. First of all, this is intended to be a friendly amendment. We know of no opposition to it. It's as a result of a bill that was passed last session, strong support, good policy. This just fine-tunes it and deals with an unintended consequence that was discovered during the interim. What has happened is a central issue with this bill was to say that if property that's got delinquent taxes on it transfers to an entity that doesn't have to pay taxes, like a public entity, state, city, county, some entity that doesn't have to pay taxes, that delinquent tax just sits on that account forever until it changes hands. So this bill, last session, was intended to say, look, if you're going to transfer property to a public entity, clean up the taxes that are delinquent and or will be owed before it transfers. That way it comes clean. What happened during the interim has to do with partial takings. And so you'll see in the amendment on page 2, whenever property that's less than an entire parcel transfers for, let's say, condemnation proceedings on strips of land for right-of-way, things like that, where the Department of Transportation might pay the taxes but just on the portion they're taking, this bill kind of created a little bit of a problem for them because there's still maybe other taxes owing on the sort of the parent account. And wasn't the intent of the assessors to make, let's say, the Department of Transportation pay the taxes on the whole account that they're not taking? So we have had long conversations with the Department of Transportation. We've said, okay, maybe this went a little too far. We didn't understand the situation. We want to fix it. We didn't intend to create this extra work for the state, cities, or counties. And Randy and Doug are here to answer questions on either the bill underlying from last session or this particular amendment, but that's the sum and substance.
Thank you. questions. I have some, but I'll let other people go first. Okay, so we have a piece of property that's 90% of which is going to be taken, or let's make up, make say half is going to be taken. The total value of the property is of the piece that's being taken might only be something close to what the taxes are due on the entire thing. Does this change mean that the taker doesn't have to pay any of the tax? Does it mean they have to pay part of it? What's the result of something like that?
Chair Barnhart, Randy Wolf, Multnomah County Assessor and Tax Collector. To answer your question, ODOT and the other various agencies have a long history of paying the taxes, and I think I would reference back to when we came to you last year with this bill. It was to solve a specific problem and give us another tool into our toolbox. Yes. We already have that existing tool of creating the separate accounts and collecting those taxes. This bill specifically last year was dealing with transfers of property in the entirety, and I gave the example last year of the Riverview Cemetery. We were in the process of canceling that tax. It transferred after July 1st. It's one example, and currently there's $4.9 million owing on that account. And $3.6 million in principal. If this bill that you passed last session, which created 311-411, had been in place right now, the taxing districts of Multnomah County would have an additional $3.6 million. After the bill passed and with the certificate, ODOT ran into the problem with how properties divided, that getting the certificate and their concern with exactly what you talked about, they're prohibited, and they may be able to speak better to this if they're here, to not pay more than the value of the property.
Right.
We have not personally at Multnomah County come up with any of those scenarios, but what this bill does is still give us, as I just said, the previous tools, and so they pay the tax on the value of the property that they're taking, but they cannot pay the tax on what's remaining. And that is the best I think I can do to answer your question.
So simply changing the definition of conveyance, which is what this amendment does, accomplishes all that? There may be more to the statute that's not here because it isn't directly affected by the amendment, and that may be where the explanation is. But the only change I see here is in the definition of conveyance.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. John Phillips and I and a couple other people met.
For the record.
Oh, Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor, met with ODOT. And this is language that we pulled out of another statute. And the original purpose of the bill was for total takings of a piece of property.
Right.
Not just a partial taking by a municipality or the state or a county.
I think I understand the concept.
Okay.
What I'm having trouble with is how the change in the definition of conveyance, which is the only change in this amendment, does what you're talking about. That's what I'm missing.
Well, it says a partial taking. Conveyance does not mean it's a very,
yes.
What we felt was a very targeted, maybe I'm misunderstanding.
Well, and how does that accomplish the goal that you have in mind? That's the thing I'm missing.
Well, when the Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, when ODOT or a county takes a right-of-way for a highway, they'll take part of it, they'll pay the tax on that, partial taking, leaves the remainder of the tax on the part that they didn't take. So not all of the property, or not all of the taxes on the property has to be paid in that situation. There still could be outstanding taxes left on the remainder part that the highway or city or state didn't take.
Okay, let me try and see if I can answer my own question.
Okay.
I think what you're trying to say is that when they take a part of a property, they will pay for that part, for the taxes on that part. But by changing the definition of conveyance here, that has the effect of maintaining the obligation on the balance of the property. Is that what this has the effect of doing?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, that was our intent, and that the burden of the remaining tax would stay on the remainder.
Let's figure this out.
And if,
okay.
I believe there's a representative from ODOT here, but that was our intent, that the remaining taxes would stay as an obligation on the remaining property.
Kyle, do you have a comment on this question?
I don't think he was there.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
So
This amendment amends the bill from last session, and
correct,
that bill starts out with saying, as used in this section, conveyance means. So if you're concerned about the changing the word conveyance for other purposes, I think that's restrictive enough.
Thank you. Line four, page one.
Exactly.
Of this amendment.
Right.
Right.
So when you first asked the question, I thought, oh, we're not intending to change conveyance for all transactions, just for the purposes of issuing a certificate saying that the taxes have been paid.
Thank you. Have we gotten there? Does this amendment do that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I missed some of it as I was running down the hall here, so I might have missed some of the back and forth. But yeah, the general idea was in House Bill 2127, which is the bill in question this makes a change to, it wouldn't allow the tax collector to essentially give the okay and transfer the title unless all the taxes are paid.
I see.
And in this case, it would allow, or it wouldn't require that to happen. So the tax collector wouldn't have to give the okay in that case. And I think it's been explained because there could be some question of having to pay the full tax.
Thank you. And because of the policy of the other agencies that tend to buy a piece of a property to make sure the taxes are already paid, we're covered.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, this was never intended to change these statutes that relate with partition plats and subdivisions and that.
And this has that effect.
Specifically, this is geared just towards the certificate issue with the conveyance and the payment of the back tax.
Thank you. Is that all clear to everyone?
Yeah.
Go ahead, yeah.
Well, Chair Barnhart, Randy Wolf, member of the committee.
The concept makes perfectly good sense to me. I just want to make sure that
works. It's very limiting to just in this situation. I think Kyle referenced that. But besides the large picture, we have large numbers of very small strip takings that this bill originally was never intended for. Very often there is little, if any, tax even owed on the incremental value, but it's broken off of large pieces of property. In our office, traditionally, we even just move the line on the map. That's all we do. This created an unintended consequence. It still remains a very valuable tool in the toolbox, and this actually provides more efficiency than what happened after the bill passed. It was unforeseen on our part.
And it prevents putting ODOT in an unconstitutionally awkward position.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, sir.
Yes. All right. Anything else? Thank you very much. I appreciate the committee's indulgence while I ask these questions.
Sure. Thank you.
All right. Any other person who wants to testify on House Bill 4110 or 4120? Don't see anybody. With that, we'll close the public hearings on those two bills. Colleagues, be aware that I have saved you 6 minutes today. I will extract them later. I don't know when. Yes, ma'am.
Could I stand at ease for a second while I ask you a question?
You want to stand at ease?
Yes, please.
Okay, well, stand at ease just for a moment. Maybe we won't save 6 minutes. Okay. Have I done all? The question was: have we done all the carryovers that we need to do, for to keep bills alive?
Yes, carryover 4131.
And that was the one I promised we would deal with tomorrow.
And 4025.
Right. Both of those. All right. Thank you. So that being all of our business today, you only save 5 minutes. With that, the committee's adjourned.